have a little bit of a longer sermon. So I'm up here like vamping, thinking, what can I cut out? Do me? I know we started late, and so let me see. I'll see what I can do here. We've been looking at the Proverbs, right? And we've been talking about, it's our membership series. We do a one-year annual membership where people can opt in. And the thing that I really wanted to focus on this morning is the everyone is us value of Blue Ocean. And I wanted to do that by starting through the book of Ruth. And it's kind of a fan favorite. Many of you guys are familiar with the book of Ruth. It's a story about a young woman called Ruth. She grew up in a region called Moab. Moab is what would be like east of Israel today, over in like Jordan region. She's a non-Jew. She's a Gentile. And she grew up there, and then at the same time, over in Israel, there was a famine, right? And so some of the Jewish residents started to come over to Moab in order to better survive that famine, and so Ruth ended up marrying one of those Jewish men. His name was, I think it's Mahlon, but Hebrew's more guttural, and I'm looking at Evan because I'm like, is it like Mahlon?
Mahon.
Okay, I'm glad I looked at you. I'm Chinese and Tibetan and German and French, not Hebrew. So thank you, Mahon, Mahlon. And so he and his family were originally from Bethlehem. And so he came over to Moab with his brother and his parents. And after moving there, he and his brother ended up getting married to local women, including Ruth. Sadly, a few short years later, all of the men died. That's not that common in the stories here. But neither of those sons who had married had any children. And so this left Ruth, this left her sister-in-law, Orpah, and their Jewish mother-in-law, Naomi, all living together in Moab. And so here we have Naomi, and she's lost her husband, and she's lost her two sons. And so she's there with her two daughters-in-law, and she's like, you know what, I'm just going to move back home to Bethlehem to be with my extended family. I want to be with my people. And so she encouraged her two daughters-in-law who were from Moab. She's like, you know, you stay here. Stay here with your people. That would be the best thing for you. But Ruth really loved her mother-in-law and actually seemed to prefer her to her own family, right? So Ruth packs up. She leaves with Naomi. They go and they settle in Bethlehem. And so being widows, both of these women were poor. But Naomi knew the tradition of her people, said that widows and the poor should be fed and cared for. Right? This is the long-standing social code. This is from the book of Leviticus. It says, also, when you harvest the crops on your land, don't cut away all of the corners of your field. Don't pick up the grain that falls on the ground. Leave it for the poor people and for foreigners who are traveling through your country. I am the Lord your God. Right? And this was, in fact, the practice of many of the people in the area in the time of this story. So if you were wealthy enough, say, to farm land, and if you considered yourself a godly person, you would leave grain in the fields for people like Ruth and Naomi to come and gather so that they could eat. Right? So it turned out there's an honorable man called Boaz who was living nearby, and he had many fields. He had many people who were working those fields. And one day we're told he noticed Ruth. And she was out there gathering the grain. So I'm just going to read from Ruth chapter 2 here. Then Boaz spoke to the man who was in charge of the workers. And he said, whose girl is that? And the man answered, she's the Moabite woman. She came with Naomi from the country of Moab. She came early this morning. She asked me if she could follow the workers and gather the grain that was left on the ground. She rested for a short time only in that shelter. And then Boaz said to Ruth, okay, listen, stay here in my field. Gather grain for yourself. There's no need for you to go to any other field. Continue following behind my woman workers. Watch to see what fields that they go to cut grain. Go follow them. I've warned the young men not to bother you. When you're thirsty, go drink from the same water jug that my men drink from. And then Ruth bowed low to the ground, and she said to Boaz, she said, I'm a foreigner. I'm really surprised that you even noticed me. And Boaz answered her, I know about all of the help that you've given to your mother-in-law, Naomi. I know you helped her even after your husband died. I know that you left your father and your mother and your own country, and you came here to this country, and you didn't know anyone from this country, but you came here with Naomi. The Lord will reward you for all of the good things you've done. The Lord, the God of Israel, will pay you in full. You have come to them for safety. They will protect you. Right? So if you know the story, you know it's a love story of sorts, or at least it's usually told that way. In that context, if there was an available man who was like an extended relative of a widowed woman, It was respectable for that man to marry the widow so that she would have resources and she'd have security, and sometimes so that land could be kept in the family. That seemed to be part of what was happening in this story. So we discover that Boaz is, in fact, an extended relative of Naomi's, right? That's kind of the big reveal in the story. Like, whoa, this like really kind, wealthy man is actually Naomi's relative, right? And while he didn't have to do it, he asked Naomi's daughter-in-law, Ruth, to be his wife so that he could ensure her security, both of their security. And so both Boaz and Ruth are described in this story as being people who like looked out for others. Right? Ruth was looking out for Naomi. She was described as having good character for doing so. Boaz was impressed by everything he had heard. People had been talking. There's this woman who's been really kind to her mother-in-law. And then Boaz looked out for both of the women, and he's described as having good character for that trait. Right? So there seems to be in the story some like mutuality here between Boaz and Ruth, almost like the story is showing us they're a good match, because they're both seen as people of integrity by their community, right? They're both seen as worthy to have been grandparents of the great King David, which is how the story tells it. It may or may not be factual, but I think the spirit of that story is people who are kind to others are like worthy of royal association, right? Let's go to the Proverbs. Proverbs 13:23. An unplowed field produces food for the poor. There's usually notes if you're looking, but I finished the sermon this morning, and so there's no notes. I'm sorry. I was out until it was a long day yesterday. I'll do my best to like, because it is a lot of scripture. An unplowed field produces food for the poor, but injustice sweeps it away. Right? So when I read that proverb, I was immediately thinking of a story of Ruth. Right? Boaz's food provided food for the poor, but if he had been unjust, he would have swept all of that clean. He would have sold all of that grain for his own profit. The Proverbs are telling people who might be tempted to skimp on helping the poor, for whatever reason, whatever rationale, the Proverbs are saying, listen to wisdom and continue to care for the poor. That is what is just, and that is what is right. Proverbs 29:7, the righteous care about justice for the poor. The wicked have no such concern. Right, so we talked in the original blessing sermon series a little bit about what it means to be righteous, because it's kind of a weird word in our context, right? Righteous just means being a person of integrity and character. It means seeking justice for all, right? We are supposed to aspire to righteousness as people of faith, like it's attainable. And part of righteousness is caring about justice for the poor, right? Then there are these weird proverbs that you can come across. So they're concerned about like property markers. Right? Proverbs 23, do not move an ancient boundary stone or encroach on the fields of the fatherless, for their defender is strong and God will take up their case against you. Right? God is on the side of the orphans, it's saying. Proverbs 22, do not move an ancient boundary stone set up by your ancestors. Proverbs 15, the Lord tears down the house of the proud, but God sets the widow's boundary stones in place. Right? So in ancient Israel, the prohibition against moving a boundary stone, it reflected this concern for protecting those who could easily be treated unfairly, like people who could get fired for coming out, right? It's reflecting that same heart of justice. Boundary stones were marking property lines. Moving them was a way that you could steal land, you could defraud somebody. And so these directives are about maintaining fairness for those who might have might not have like the social or the legal power to defend their rights, right? So the time frame of the Bible, it spans centuries. There are lots of variations on the law about whether or not widows could own property or not, depending on the time and place. But widows in ancient Israelite society generally did have certain property rights, right? So if somebody's husband died, she might retain the possession of the land that belonged to him, especially if there were no male heirs. However, that would often leave her open to exploitation. Like I was thinking about in Ruth and Naomi's case, I was like, I think the thing that could happen is Naomi was able, like her sons would have inherited the land, it said, but somebody could have married Ruth and then divorced, like taken the land legally and then just divorced her and then kept the land and like married someone else and kept it in that family line. And so that's a way that that could be open to exploitation, which is why biblical law and teachings are often emphasizing protecting widows. Right, moving a widow's boundary stone was seen as a way of like really taking advantage of her weakened status. And so the Bible commands against it to ensure justice. Right? And so I've been highlighting Proverbs' concern here, right, with generosity, with caring for the poor, with caring for people who could easily be taken advantage of. because we're talking about Blue Ocean values, right? And part of what it means to be a follower of Jesus, part of what it means to be shaped by Christianity, is caring for those with less social power. And that means both within our community as well as outside of it, right? I don't like to talk like, oh yeah, it's we're the people who have and we need to go and like give it, like we are humanity. Like we all exist right in here, right? Some of us relate more to Ruth and to Naomi at this point in our lives, and some of us might relate a little bit more to Boaz, and that's okay, right? We often find ourselves at these different places at different times of life. But what the Bible encourages us to do, tells us to do, is to give generously out of our abundance. So if you're in a place where you have abundance, that we give generously like Boaz did, right? And when we don't feel guilty about it. Don't feel guilty about like accepting food so that you can eat. I would say giving out of abundance doesn't mean that we don't get to have boundaries about giving or being generous with our money, right? We don't have to feel bad if we can't help everyone who asks. So in 2 Corinthians, Paul says, the desire is not that others might be relieved while you're hard-pressed, right? That's not the goal, right? Boaz was able to give away food from his fields while he was maintaining a whole staff of farmhands, probably making a decent living, and that is okay. My dad, who I talk about a lot now, both of my parents actually, my mom might be online, they taught us kids to live below our means so that we can be generous with others, right? That's what it means to be Christian. My dad, at the height of his earning power, was giving away 20% of his money. And then he couldn't because he got sick, and then they weren't able to do that. But he did that because he said, I don't expect you to give away 20% of your money. We don't hit that mark ourselves. But just like to know that like that's what shaped me, and to know that I try to practice what I preach. It's easy to tell people to be generous with their money when you have it, but I think it's like so core to Christian discipleship to give out of our abundance that it's hard to overstate it. And I'm not saying this for like tithing. Like people have come from like so many churches where you felt like manipulated for tithing. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about caring for others in our communities by giving out of what the Lord has blessed us with. And there are times when you're like, I just can't do it. I've been there, right? I've been there where I did not have it, where I lost my job after 2007 and 8. My wife lost her job after 2007 and 8. I know that place. So there's no shame in that place. But when you're able, it's like the Lord is saying, like, you'll have your needs met. Live a little below your means if you're able so that you can give more away. All of that was outside of my notes here, so I don't even know where I'm at. I just always talk about like giving away money. It helps us like detach, right? From earning power as identity, which is like such an American thing. It keeps us from depending solely on money. It teaches us that we depend on our Creator. We depend upon our communities, that God provides for the birds of the air and the flowers of the field, right? And that's part of our spiritual shaping. So we talk a lot about everyone is us, right? That Archbishop Desmond Tutu, he was the Anglican Church in South Africa. He would teach, I am because you are. Right? And that comes from the Zulu philosophy of Ubuntu, which teacher Sarah over there teaches at the Ubuntu school. There's like an entire like preschool here in Ann Arbor that's surrounding this principle. And it's just talking about how humans are all connected. And so it's recognizing just the universal bond that we have, that we have differences. Of course, right? We come from different cultures and different traditions. We speak different languages, and this is beautiful. But underlying those, we have a core humanity, that good done to you is good done to me. Harm done to you is harm done to me. And Jesus taught something very similar in Matthew 25. He said, you know, when you give food to hungry strangers, if you give water to people who are thirsty, it's like you're doing it unto Jesus himself. Truly I tell you, whatever you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do for me. All right, so caring for the hungry and the sick and the poor simply because we are human is central to our faith. That's what Jesus' ministry was all about, right? Luke chapter 4, he goes into his synagogue to open up his ministry. He pulls out the scroll of Isaiah, and he says, this is what I am about, proclaiming good news to the poor, freedom for the prisoners, setting the oppressed free, proclaiming the year of the Lord's favor. Jubilee had to do with financial justice for people who were overburdened by debt, right? So I think if we try to reflect Jesus's ministry as much as we're able, given sort of our size and abilities, we reflect those values. Right, so Bishop Yvette Flunder, she's the presiding bishop of the Fellowship of Affirming Ministries. That's the umbrella organization to which our church belongs. This is what she says about the fellowship. So the overriding purpose of the fellowship is to support religious teachers and laity in moving toward a theology of radical inclusivity, which by its very nature requires an equally radical social ministry, reaching to the furthest margins of society to serve all in need without prejudice and without discrimination, right? So I said it last week, I'll say it again. I think our church itself is a radical social ministry, right? We offer pastoral care and community and discipleship to people who often face tremendous prejudice and discrimination in other parts of the church and other parts of their lives. Right, Rabbi Dr. Shmuley Yankowitz says, one can be moral and effective in work to serve the vulnerable and not embrace God. In other words, right, you can be a moral person and not embrace God, absolutely. Just as one can be devout religiously and not create any serious impact through social action. That's absolutely true too. As a guiding principle, however, embracing God offers us the opportunity to raise the bar that we set for what we want to achieve and how we must achieve it. Right, so I will say, like, as a pastor, one of the things I feel obligated to ensure is that our church does not shape the kind of Christians who are, as the good rabbi says, devout religiously, but who don't care about social action or care for the poor. Right, and so that's why we participate collectively and things like serving meals to people who are food insecure at the Hope Clinic. Nancy's here. Nancy's been leading that for the last couple of years. Joy Lang led it for decades before her. Many of you volunteer there, right? It's why we serve a meal to the unhoused on Christmas Day. I think we're going to do it again this year. Stay tuned. It's why we work with Jewish Family Services to help resettle refugee families. It's why the youth group was gathering food for food gatherers. It's why we gather food sometimes for the backdoor food pantry, which operates out of that yellow house in front of us called the Wisdom House. It's why I've been proposing that we're going to put a little bit of money in the upcoming budget for the Ipsy Youth Choir, led by Crystal back there. Right? I mean, I think what you're doing is great regardless. But I remember talking to Crystal, and she was a little bit like, well, you know, we meet at the Ipsy Free Methodist Church. We might not agree with everything they teach, but they provide a free meal on Monday nights to people who need it. And so if people who are in the choir need something to eat, or if maybe people who might want to come to choir need that, they can also do both of those things. And I remember thinking, it's like you're Christian or something, Crystal. Like, of course, that makes a lot of sense. And I say, like, we could all volunteer at JFS, and we could all volunteer at Hope Clinic on our own. I encourage you to do such things. But we've made it an integrated part of Blue Ocean, because when we do it together, we remind ourselves that this is what Christians do, right? This is who we are. This is part of our discipleship into what it means to follow Jesus. And so we practice it together, and we bring people along with us, and we let it shape our collective hearts. And I think we actually do quite a bit for a church our size. I try to have us participate in what we're able to do without overstretching, because obviously we can't do everything, and so I'm pretty protective of adding too much. But that's part of why we do it together. And so I just wanted to kind of close out by letting you know that we have been asked to help resettle another refugee family through JFS in the coming few months. We don't know when they'll show up. Could be next week, could be in 2 months. Kind of have to stay tuned. Last time we did it, I kind of want to share for some of you who may not have been around. Last time we did it, we partnered with a Presbyterian church, Westminster Presbyterian, met a lot of lovely people there, and it took a lot of community effort, right? So we had a family who arrived from Afghanistan. The father had helped out the U.S. military during our time there, and so they were in some danger when the Taliban came back to power, and man, am I glad they're here now seeing what the Taliban has done for women. So they relocated here. It was particularly challenging for us for a few reasons. One was that they spoke a dialect for which it was almost impossible to find a translator. And so that made some things really especially hard. They had several kids, and that made it hard to find an apartment with the budget that the State Department gives. But I just want you to know, like, if you weren't here, like, our community just, like, really stepped up. We donated a lot of money, a lot of furniture, Some of us met over there, like moved furniture, cleaned the apartment, prepared it for them to get there. There's a couple of people who are dentists in our church, and they provided a lot of much-needed dental care. Pastor Diane, I usually say, does heroic work. She was driving people around, getting the kids enrolled in school. She was like the liaison between the school and the family because of the communication barrier. Really helped those kids get settled here. This time we'll take a lesser role, because I don't know if we could quite sustain that level of involvement. But we were asked to partner with the Unitarian Universalist Church that's out on Scio Church. And they did this last time too, and apparently they've got like a really good team, like a strong coalition. St. Clair's is going to be helping. I said we would do it. I said our strengths tend to be raising money for very specific needs, finding and moving furniture, and like we're really good at like showing up for one-time stuff, right? Clean an apartment, like we can gather people for that stuff. Some of the sustained ongoing is a little bit hard, especially because we have so many young families. So showing up to like teach English a couple times a week can be a little bit hard. So just so you know, JFS is one of only 23 organizations across the country that the State Department officially partners with to resettle people who have refugee status. It sounds like right now a lot of the families are coming from Ukraine. Some are also coming from El Salvador, Afghanistan, and the Congo, Democratic Republic of the Congo. So I'll just kind of keep you posted as that comes. That was a little bit of a longer sermon. It was for me too, but I kind of wanted to know, especially if you're newer, like, what we do and why we do it. Like, I actually had somebody ask me, like, yeah, but why would I need to volunteer through the church? You don't, but here's why we do it. Because together, like, JFS, they come to faith communities because they know that together we have some organizing power that we wouldn't have if we were just individuals doing it, right? We can come together with two other faith communities and, like, make that happen. And then it shapes also sort of our collective spiritual journey as well, so... With that, we usually do meditation or a guided meditation. And I think let's just take a minute, not even a minute, but just like some silence. Just kind of let the Spirit settle on us. We've had a lot of information. Just Spirit be among us here. Holy Spirit, as we're just thinking through in these few weeks, like who we are and reminding ourselves of why we exist and our values, I ask that you continue to help us to be able to be a refuge for people who need refuge, a healing community for people who need healing, a place that reduces shame for people who have been made to feel so much shame. I ask that we would be a place that would reflect your love into our communities, that we'd be a place where we can reflect your love with each other and take care of each other. And we ask that you would shape us and disciple us to be radically inclusive, as Yvette Flunder prays, and that means just reaching the margins of our communities, and that we would be a people who are able to do that so that we can reflect your love and so that we can thrive and be free in who you've made us to be. Amen.